What is Maine? Who is Maine? What are the stories of those who have lived here from the beginning, that migrated here, and that continue to inhabit this unique place? These are Conversations from the Pointed Firs.
Welcome to Conversations from the Pointed Firs. I'm your host, Peter Neal. My guest today is Lucas St. Clair, outdoorsman, land conservationist, educator, and philanthropist. Born and raised in a hand-built cabin off the grid in northern Maine, cordon bleu chef and advocate for sustainable foodways, and president of the Elliottsville Foundation, a private operating foundation with the mission to advance the relationship, innovative land conservation, and community-based economic development in Maine. Lucas, welcome to Conversations from the Pointed Firs. Thanks for joining.
Thanks for having me, Peter.
So I usually begin at the beginning, and yours is a very interesting beginning.
I am the son of a couple that moved to Maine during the Back to the Land movement in the early 70s, came from San Francisco to northern Maine where they could afford land, and bought a bit of land, built a cabin, and lived far off the grid. And 1978 had twins, my sister and I. And we were brought up there in sort of northern Piscataquis County. We're the first twins born at Mayo Regional Hospital in Dover Foxcroft, and lived about a half a mile beyond the end of the Andrews Road down a trail through the woods.
Talk a little bit about that setting. Where's the nearest neighbor?
The nearest neighbor was probably a half a mile away or so. There weren't a lot of people. You know, Piscataquis County is still the least populated county, I think, in Maine. So there weren't a lot of people around other than my mom and dad and our dog, Sid. My sister and I spent a lot of time outside, as lots of young Mainers do. It was a pretty idyllic lifestyle, really. I can't remember wanting for anything. I didn't obviously know about much else. Despite being pretty idyllic, it was relatively secluded. So I didn't know what it was like to have electric lights or televisions or things like that. That all being said, it was a great start in life, and I really loved being able to use my imagination and spend as much time outside as we did. And it really kind of centered my appreciation for the outdoors. But we didn't live that way for that long, to be perfectly honest. You know, my parents were separated and divorced when I was still pretty young, and they lived in the area and lived relatively simple lifestyles still. It wasn't quite as extreme as the cabin that I was born in, but it took us a while to get electricity. But we slowly sort of integrated into a more modern lifestyle, living still in Piscataquis County.
And the subsistence was what? It started out as the back to the land and farming around the cabin, and then what happened?
Yeah, that's right. You know, they had a co-op with other folks. You know, the last real in-migration into Piscataquis County was in the late 60s and early 70s when a lot of back to the landers moved in. So there was a community of folks that were, you know, ordering peanut butter in bulk and splitting it apart at the Grange Hall. And so, you know, they grew some food, but it's, as you know, the growing season's not super long here in Maine. And that was the way we lived for the first 5 or 6 years of our lives. And then my mom moved over to a town called Parkman, and there was a one-room schoolhouse that she rented there that was where we lived. And my dad moved over to Dover, and he bought a little house behind the hospital, and he got electricity there. So we kind of settled in, and we started kind of switching back and forth between the school systems that were over in toward Guilford and Dexter and the ones toward Dover. And we were kind of did that bouncing around between those school systems and those rural communities until high school, really.
Really? And where'd you go to high school?
Both my sister and I went to Gould Academy over in Bethel, Maine. You know, despite that kind of 13 or 14 year history sounding pretty remote and isolated, my mom started Burt's Bees in the mix of that period of time. And so when she started the company, by the time I got to high school, she was able to pay for us to go to boarding school. And it was something that I particularly wanted to do. My parents being spread apart by about 20 or 30 miles, caused a lot of disruption moving back and forth between houses a week here and a week there. And, you know, I knew that there was a world out there that I wanted a little more exposure to. And I felt like a change was something that I would really benefit from. And so we ultimately agreed to send us to boarding school, which we started in the early 90s.
Was your sister along with you?
Yeah, we went together. Yeah, it was great when we spent all 4 years there.
And did you feel prepared when you got there, but either socially and intellectually? I mean, you'd had a pretty interesting early childhood education.
Yeah, I mean, I think children at that age are really resilient and can kind of adapt to anything. And I felt like we were able to do that pretty easily. But, you know, in growing up in Piscataquis County, I also felt like a bit of an outsider. You know, my parents were living a very different lifestyle than most people in the region were living. Going to grade school and not having, you know, running water or television or electricity was a really different thing. And so we were somewhat of the outsiders there. And while we were living in somewhat extreme poverty, it was poverty that was chosen. So it wasn't really like we were forced into this poverty. And my parents were from different places. They'd moved there from San Francisco. So they weren't really identified as Mainers. And so despite growing up in this kind of rustic and rural life, it wasn't one that was really customary to people in Piscataquis County. So I was kind of prepared to try to fit in into a community that I wasn't from. And when I went to boarding school, I had a similar approach that there were people, you know, my roommate my freshman year was from Hong Kong. And, you know, it was a very different experience, but it was one that I felt like I was able to adapt to because I felt like I'd been adapting for most of my life.
Yeah, I have had a similar experience. I can remember the first day at school and I felt completely alienated and outside. And the only other person who I felt was more an outlier than I was the Japanese exchange student. I was from the Midwest, and the Midwest didn't even exist in the minds of most of my classmates. did you discover avocation there?
That's a good question. I mean, what I really felt like I was able to get exposed to at Gould was an appreciation for the diversity of leadership. I felt I wasn't particularly academically inclined or motivated. I was very interested in the arts. And when I first started spending time in the outdoors with groups, I start to recognize a natural comfort, which ultimately led to a form of leadership in the outdoors. And it really gave me this unique appreciation for the diversity of people and what we all bring to any situation. So I began to find a voice both in my artistic endeavors and being in the outdoors. Obviously I spent so much time outside as a kid, I felt really comfortable there anyway. So then I felt like I could use my comfort in the outdoors to help others feel comfortable and grow those skills. And the academics, you know, I was sort of average, you know, an average student. I did just enough that I needed to get by, but really applied myself in those other places.
Were you in the shadow of your twin?
Yeah, very much so. She was a very dedicated student. She was, you know, an honor roll and really sort of beloved by everyone at school because she was the captain of the lacrosse team and of the field hockey team. And she gave parents tours when they came to, you know, prospective kids when they're looking at school, she would show them around. Yeah. So, you know, in a lot of ways, she was a model a student there. But, you know, what I was able to do was, I was very comfortable with adults. And so I may not have excelled in all of my schoolwork. I still would babysit my history teacher's kids. And, you know, and that was the kind of beauty of a boarding school community, especially, and that wasn't super focused on college placement. You know, it was really about developing you as an individual. And so I really got a lot out of that experience.
You had an advantage from your early childhood, I guess, by being comfortable by being alone. I mean, boarding school can be a very lonely place.
Yeah, I think, you know, in some ways it can, but it also, for me, it was much more exposure to my peers than I'd ever had before. So, you know, in that sense, it was really more socially stimulating than my early childhood.
Mm-hmm. And the same thing holds true for the outdoors. I mean, in the sense that you were comfortable outdoors before you got into kind of formal recreational experience within the landscape. And that would be a characteristic of leadership as well, I would think, simply because you were comfortable.
Yeah, I think that's right.
So that let's follow that line for a minute. That line takes you then from school, university. I don't know what you did with college, but it also took you to the Appalachian Trail and to the canoe trail, to the outdoors in a kind of much more aggressive and I'm sure psychologically important and satisfying way.
Yeah, when I finished high school, I had an academic advisor that said, you know, maybe take a year off. Maybe take a year, kind of, you've done a lot of the maturing that most students do when they get to college, you know, so you don't have to really worry about that. And think about how you want to spend your time. And when I was little, my dad took me up Katahdin, and I remember seeing the sign on Baxter Peak, and there was an arrow at the bottom of the sign that said Springer Mountain, Georgia, 2,200 miles, and thought, oh my goodness, you could hike a treadway all the way to Georgia. What an amazing thing. And so I always sort of planted that in my mind of something to do. And so when I thought, oh, if I could take a year off and not go right to college, maybe I'll go hike the Appalachian Trail. And so the timing worked out, and that's what I set off to do. And it was an incredible experience, you know, one that completely changed my life. I had a completely new appreciation for my own personal capacity and capability, knowing that a project just one step at a time, learning the fact that you can do anything really if you just take it in little pieces. And, you know, I finished that experience feeling like I could really do anything.
And you did the whole trail by yourself?
Yeah, I did the whole trail by myself. I started in March in Georgia and worked my way all the way up to Maine. But it's a very social experience. There's a lot of hikers out there. I hiked with some folks for 500, 600, 700 miles along the way. So it was really a social time, although I was walking by myself most days. But yeah, it really fundamentally changed my trajectory and ultimately led me to really pursue outdoor adventures, including the Northern Forest Canoe Trail and then kind of ultimately started to hone in on the kind of leadership training in the outdoors and took a semester with the National Outdoor Leadership School. That really was an incredible experience as well.
Right. Did you ever go to college?
No, I never did. Yeah. I felt like if I wanted to learn anything, just like if I wanted to walk anywhere, I could do it. You know, I could figure out exactly what I wanted to learn. And the way I was brought up was to be intensely curious. And my father became a social worker after getting a degree in chemistry, and my mother became an entrepreneur after getting a degree in fine arts. So I thought, well, there's no real relationship between what you study and what you do. And, you know, why not focus on things that I'm really curious about?
Yeah.
And the thing that really stood out in all these outdoor pursuits was morale centered around food. And if you were fed well, you would feel better and the group would perform better and the morale would be higher. And so in between all of these outdoor recreational pursuits, I started working in bakeries and restaurants and sometimes as a server and sometimes as a cook. But I really became interested in the hospitality world. And so when I finished the Knowles expedition, I decided that I'd go to culinary school. And I always had a real interest in the trades, in carpentry and in furniture making. And and cooking. And so I thought, well, I'll go to a trade school and learn how to cook. And then if I, you know, regardless of whatever I do, I can always just go cook somewhere. Or I can wait tables somewhere. And it was just this great way to hone my skill and get a sort of passport for occupation, it felt like.
Well, London was a big step. You could have done it in New York. You could have done it in a lot of different places. But how did that happen?
Yeah, you know, something my mom said to me one time, she's like, you know, if you're going to study, you should learn all the rules before you break the rules. You should go, if you're going to study, you know, fine art, go to Florence. If you're going to study culinary arts, it probably should be in Europe somewhere. And I thought about going to Paris and did spend some time there at culinary school, but I didn't speak French, and London seemed like a big European city to be in, but didn't require the cultural and language requirements that I did not have. So I thought London would be a great jumping off point, which I loved. It was, you know, at that time it was in the late 90s. It's an incredibly cosmopolitan city. The, you know, great European chefs were there. You know, Gordon Ramsay was starting his career at that point, had just gotten 3 Michelin stars at his restaurant in London. And Marco Pierre White had gotten 3 Michelin stars at the Ivy. You know, it was a very, very interesting time to be in London in the food world, the restaurant world. And it was attracting international attention. Unlike the reputation for English food wasn't the greatest. And then all of a sudden it was going through this bit of a revolution while I was there, which was really exciting.
I was in the military in Paris. And one of the things I would do at night is around the corner, there was a 3-star restaurant and there was a little alley that went down the side. There was a window and you could look in that window and you could see the stovetops, and all you could see were the skillets and the hands. And you never saw the faces of the cooks, but all you could do was see the way their hands were moving. And there were all these aspiring young chefs crowded around this window in the middle of the night, watching the preparation. And I kept saying, well, this is astonishing because it's two things at the same time. It's a beautiful choreography, and it has to be organized in such a way that you can maintain the quality for each dish every time. It isn't just a one-off. And that realization, it can inform the way you are in the world far beyond whether or not you're going to work in a restaurant. Mm-hmm. You understand the beauty of work, but also to understand the need to be skillful and efficient and consistent. I think that's true of any trade, actually.
Yeah, it really is. I mean, the thing that's so unique about a restaurant is that most industries have sales. You know, you're selling something and then you're making something. And so you have a sales force and then you have a manufacturing facility and you have, you know, delivery and all the logistics that go into that. And in a restaurant, you have all those things, but they're all in the same place happening at the same time in a very short period of time.
This is Conversations from the Pointed Furs, a monthly interview program with artists, authors, and exemplars who invoke the spirit of Maine. Broadcast live the first Friday of every month here on WERU Community Radio, 89.9 FM, streaming and archived at weru.org and available as podcast at pointedfurs.org. My guest today is Lucas St. Clair, philanthropist, land conservationist, outdoorsman, president of the Elliottsville Foundation, and civic leader.
It's just an amazing way to see see commerce unfold. And as you said, it's extremely exacting and it's such high pressure. And it's not like you send the thing out to the consumer and then they open up a box and take it out and look at it and try it on and decide, eh, you know, this isn't quite right. I'm going to send it back and I'm going to get the other size. You know, it's like, it doesn't happen like that. And, you know, you're immediately seeing the reaction of the customer, and the food that is perishable. So you can't just add a little more salt, or, you know, very rarely can you cook it a little bit longer and make it just right. It's a very high stakes industry that has a tremendous amount of pressure. But because of that, it helps you, or it helped me at least, understand how to work well in a team. And I think that's what I miss most about working in the restaurant industry now, is just being a part of a team that is so focused on this singular outcome, which is to provide an experience for the guest night after night after night.
Right. It's an interesting parallel when you think about it, between being part of a team and being a solo walker in the wilderness. You know, it's a challenge in the sense that you have to succeed. But one, you're absolutely by yourself, and the other, you're supported in some way by people who understand how it all fits together. It's pretty interesting life education when I think about it. When you start putting these pieces together into an amalgam of teaching and learning, the foodways in Maine have changed quite a bit. We now have so many excellent restaurants. We have more and more young farmers. Again, a third back to the land movement, as far as I can see, with a whole other attitude and a growing public interest. I mean, you can measure it with the Mofka Fair. I mean, it started out, there were 2,000 people, and last fall there were 50,000 people, and that's some kind of a massive expansion of interest of people who are interested in living that way, growing their own food in some way or another, consuming it, making it better, and sort of getting the values that are associated with the security that you can find in food.
Yeah, in 1972, when my parents moved from San Francisco to Maine, it was because they felt San Francisco was becoming too industrial. The Trans-American building had just been built, and they felt like, oh my gosh, this corporate society is taking over. And there was a real need to return back to earth and back to the land, quite literally. And I think there's that feeling happening now, you know, whereas we are in virtual conversations and our virtual work, and we've become more and more interconnected virtually, but disconnected personally. I think that there's a real desire to get back to what feels very real. And, you know, Mofka is a great example because it's the oldest organic farmers and gardening organization in the United States. And yet it's having a wave of newfound success. And the food movement has been here in Maine, you know, Helen and Scott Nearing and the Four Seasons Farm. And these things have been in Maine for a long, long time. And they're being reinvented and reemerging in the form of really wonderful hospitality and restaurants and young farmers. And it's definitely an exciting thing to see, but it does feel sort of cyclical.
Who cooks in your house?
We sort of divide the cooking responsibility between my wife and I. I you know, if we have guests, I'll cook. And then, you know, night after night, we kind of split it up. Tonight, I'm going to cook. But, you know, I get a little frustrated because I like to cook kind of adventurous things, and not everybody in my family. I've got a 10 and 13-year-old children, and they're not quite as adventurous in their tastes as I am in my cooking. But it can be a little bit demoralizing to, you know, ferment black beans and make a Szechuan paste and cook something like that. And they're like, oh, this doesn't taste good.
I know the feeling. There's camaraderie in it, though. There's nothing better than the family table or the friends around the table and sort of cooking together. And, you know, it's one of those things that we take for granted a little bit unless we don't have the opportunity to do it. And, of course, so many people don't. Mm-hmm. This all comes together. You've moved back to Maine, and this all comes together just exactly how. What was the catalyst that sort of created this second half, let's call it, of your life?
Well, I worked in the hospitality industry for about 12 years. I worked in New York and Maine, and then ultimately moved to Seattle. I spent 7 years out there working in the restaurant and wine industry. And then in 2012, started paying closer attention to what my mom was up to with her work in conserving lands in northern Maine. And My wife and I had just had our first child, and I was thinking, this is not an industry that's very conducive to raising family and being with family. I work at night and it's stressful hours. And so I thought, I need to do something else now. This has sort of run its course for me. And my mom offered me an opportunity to come back to Maine and work on this project with her. And the last job I was doing in the restaurant business was I was working as a sommelier for a giant restaurant that had the grand award from the Wine Spectator. And we had thousands of bottles of wine on our lists. And every night I would have to go and talk to strangers, a table of strangers after a table of strangers, and try to figure out what they wanted to drink. And Seattle is a very casual city. Everyone sort of wears a fleece vest, and everyone looks like they're come stepping off the catalog pages of REI. But there's great wealth, and there's people celebrating, and there's people on vacation, and there's people that are just grabbing a quick bite to eat before the theater. And I would always be tasked with trying to figure out who was sitting at this table, what they wanted, and how to serve them the right bottle of wine. And the wine was, some of it was $50 a bottle and some of it was thousands and thousands of dollars a bottle. And so I spent a lot of time trying to use my intuition to judge what people were like. And I thought, I bet I could apply that same type of skill to working in the Katahdin region, talking to strangers, trying to figure out where their motivations are, what their needs were, what their wishes were, and how to try to find common ground. And it wasn't related to wine. It was related to land, which I would say is a lot more personal. But it gave me this sense that and my other life experience, that I could completely try something new. And I could go back to the place that I grew up and spent a lot of time as a kid and potentially move this project down the road, which was what my mom's goal was, of creating a new national park. And so in 2012, my wife and year-old daughter moved back to Maine and set about on this very new chapter in my career and life.
Can we talk about that more specifically? Because it's I followed it from afar. It wasn't easy what you all set out to do. People resisted. There was confrontation. There was a lot of misinformation and bias, it seemed to me, that I read about, which I found extraordinary, that this brilliant idea of capitalizing on what are the greatest aspects of life in Maine, its remaining wilderness, would be so dramatically and resisted at the beginning. Am I right? Is in that understanding of the history?
Yeah, there were certainly people that were not supportive of the concept of a national park. I will say that I didn't meet anyone that didn't think that this area was pretty special. There was a real attachment to the land. It was more about what to do with it. And for 100 years or so, the land was used to extract spruce and fir and float down the river and make paper. And in the communities that were closest to the proposed park, they were living in these extraordinary communities that centered around these giant paper mills. And in the 1980s, they were the largest paper mills in the world. And everyone in town was either employed directly or indirectly by the mill. Mm-hmm. And you graduate from high school, which was a wonderful high school that had incredible basketball team and performing arts, and you graduate from high school and you could go to work for the mill, and it was a pretty extraordinary place to live. That the Millinocket was nicknamed the Magic City. It had the highest per capita income in the state. Yeah. And then all of a sudden it started to decline. And the writing was on the wall for a while, but if you were living in that community for several generations, it was, I think, pretty hard to understand what was happening with all the global forces that were being put on papermaking in Maine. And ultimately, after a couple decades, these mills all but vanished. And it left people with a real sense of fear and change that they were not in control of, and a way of life that was really beneficial just left. And I think people were looking for someone to blame. And I think people were really nervous about what was to come. And people really wanted to go back to a time that was never really going to happen again. And in the midst of all of that, this 100,000 acres or so of land was for sale, and my mom bought it and proposed something that was very different than a working forest and a paper mill. It was giving the land to the federal government. And in Maine, we don't have a lot of federally owned land. We have very, very little. And so there's no precedent for it. There's very little understanding of it. The one national park we have here is Acadia, which is so very different than what we were proposing. And, you know, it really was a disruptive and disorienting moment in history of the North Maine woods. And what I think my mom did most of the really hard work. My mom was the one that bought up all the parcels of land, despite what you read about. All of those properties were offered to her to be bought. She didn't go out seeking to purchase them. And then she proposed this pretty amazing concept that was met with such great resistance. And she was able to hear what people in the community were saying and put together a model that ultimately took into account a lot of what the community was wanting and needing. But it was hard for her to be able to articulate that in the press and in community, just because she had been the tip of the spear for so long. So what the project really needed was this kind of refresh. And that was the role that I played. I was going to be a very different voice, at a very different time in the timeline. You know, my mom had been working on it for, you know, she bought the first property in the late 90s, and I didn't start working on it until 2012. And it was finished in 2016. So she had been at it for almost a decade and a half until I came along. So it was very confrontational. There were people that were very emotional on both sides of the debate. And ultimately, the way it happened was a bit of an end run around our congressional delegation, who at the time were not supportive of what we were doing. And so to have the president create it rather than having Congress create it, I think right, fueled some of that discontent. And here we are, 8 years past the creation date, and it's a very, very different feeling in the region. The housing stock is more valuable. There's young people moving to the area. There's outdoor recreation is actually understood as a real industry. There are people capitalizing on the outdoor recreation. There's Katahdin Woods and Waters National Monument's getting about 50,000 visitors a year, and that's only going to grow and grow as people learn about it. It's been classified as a dark sky sanctuary, one of only a few in the country. We're about to be complete with this incredible new welcome center that's been built, being built over the last 5 years or so. It's a real reestablishment of Indigenous culture within the National Monument. So there's a tremendous amount of excitement and enthusiasm that's really changed the conversation dramatically over the last almost 8 years.
Yeah. Go back and parse the original concept, the principles that were different from the Acadia experience. The land is different, but also your mother, I think, had a very different kind of vision for how the land was to be used as a public facility.
Yeah.
In more detail?
So initially she thought, wouldn't it be great if it was a giant national park? And then she got a lot of feedback from people in the region that said, you know, part of our tradition here is hunting and fishing, snowmobiling, and we'd like to have those traditional things incorporated into it. So she started looking at some of the big parks in Alaska and the Alaska Lands Act that Jimmy Carter put a lot of land into conservation up there. And then 1980, ANILCA was signed and created these parks and preserves. And the parks were acting like Acadia, kind of the similar rules. And then the preserves were allowing for some of those more intensive uses like hunting. And so we thought, what about creating a park and preserve model in the Katahdin region? And that's really what we started to lean into. It's like, let's allow for snowmobiling in some places, not everywhere. But in the places that it really is important to have those snowmobile trails for long connectivity, for so the communities are able to ride on the trails that they've been riding on. And let's have hunting in places. Let's not have it everywhere. You know, I'm not a big fan or supporter of multi-use. You know, if you're going to have a biking trail, have a biking trail and then have a walking trail over here. Because when bikers and walkers are really close together, it doesn't always work. There's user conflict. So why not create some places to hunt and everybody knows where those places are, and then places where hunting is not allowed. And so that's ultimately what was established in Katahdin Woods and Waters.
And tell me about the political process. You had opposition on the ground. You had a congressional delegation that was reacting to that opposition and not supporting the process. How did it happen that the president took this matter in hand?
Well, there needed to be public support, whether it was going to happen through Congress or it was going to happen through presidential proclamation. And so my effort was to create congressional support, get a bill passed through Congress. And so I went out and looked for public support and looked to the boards of selectmen and town councils and chambers of commerce and rotaries and local landowners and various different user groups and just worked to get support. And the support grew. It grew faster on the ground than it did in the minds of the congressional offices. And really, at the time, we had Congressman Bruce Poliquin, who was very opposed and ideologically, I think, opposed to having the federal government own land. So regardless of what was going to happen on the ground, I don't think he was ever going to get to a place where he would support something like this. Senator Collins was paying a bit closer attention, but never got to a place where she was going to support a new national park. And you know, her perspective of the economy in the North Maine Woods is about forestry. And that's what she knows the most and is most familiar with. And so that's where she was listening, and folks in the forest products industry were opposed to the monument. So that's she never got there. And then Senator King, you know, he had a deeper appreciation for national parks. He was, when he finished his role as governor, he traveled around national parks around the country and really saw how they are not just these incredible natural resources, but they're also these places that highlight American culture and they tell stories. And, you know, there are many people that will argue that it's the best publicly funded system of education in America. It tells the American story. And so he started thinking, well, look at this. This is an incredible place. It's got a bounty of natural resources, but it's also this tremendous history going back tens of thousands of years in the ancestral homelands of the Penobscots. And then settlers came in and harvested timber and fur trading and the amazing development of papermaking and the log drives. And then now in moving into the hands of conservation, like this is a phenomenal American story that should be told. And so he started to think maybe we could do something here. And as he started having more conversations with people in the region, we were starting to bring the positive support that was growing in the region to the White House. And we were meeting with the Council for Environmental Quality, and we were meeting with members of the Department of Interior and the National Park Service, and we're saying, hey, look, there's a lot of support here for this, and we want to gift this land. We want to give with this land an endowment so it won't cost the American taxpayer money. Think about how this would really benefit not only the American public, but this administration. You know, the 100th anniversary of the National Park Service is on August 25th, 2016. Think about it, a landscape-sized park in the East Coast that we could celebrate the 100th anniversary with.
This is Conversations from the Pointed Firs, a monthly interview program with artists, authors, and exemplars who invoke the spirit of Maine. Broadcast live the first Friday of every month here on WERU Community Radio, 89.9 FM, streaming and archived at weru.org and available as podcast at pointedfirs.org. My guest today is Lucas St. Clair, philanthropist, land conservationist, outdoorsman, president of the Elliottsville Foundation, and civic leader.
And so the White House started getting more and more excited, and he said, well, you know, in order for us to do this, we have to have a public meeting in the region. And in order to have a public meeting in the region, we have to be invited by one of your congressional elected officials. And So we thought our best chance would be to have Senator King. He may make that request. And ultimately he did. And the representative of the White House was Director John Jarvis, who was the director of the National Park Service. And they had a public meeting in Orono. And over 1,000 people came. And it was like 10-1 people for supporting the monument to people that were opposed to it. And so I thought, all right, look, there's support in the region. We were invited by the senator from the state. The family wants to give this land. Now it's just about logistics. And we have to figure out how do we actually transfer the land to the federal government from this family and make it happen. Those were the politics that, you know, there were obviously a lot of nuances to that storyline, but that was in a nutshell how we got from concept moving away from a piece of legislation and ultimately to a presidential proclamation.
There weren't a lot of you in the sense that you were speaking for the family. This is a very complicated process filled with inexplicable nuance. You had to be able to articulate it. You must have been discouraged often. It's the kind of political process that, you know, most of us have no idea how much work goes into something like this. Forget about the fact of the land itself. It's the investment of energy and imagination that's placed into the project that eventually triumphed in a way. I mean, 10-1 is a clear statement of intent and enthusiasm and welcome for the gift. That process was fairly intense in time. I don't want to pander, but I have to say, I really say hats off for being able to be part of the group that led that transformation of welcome.
Well, thank you for saying that. You know, I will say that the hike along the Appalachian Trail, like knowing that it's just a continuous one step after another, there were times when the wind would blow and storms would come through and blisters and all that. And it was just sort of that knowing that constant steady pressure was going to get us there. So there was that kind of knowing in my mind that was incredibly helpful. Being a very optimistic person, knowing that, yeah, there's going to be some setbacks that are going to be really frustrating, but I'm optimistic that we're going to get it done. And then the thing that I just have, I'm just so thankful for this group of people that I got to work with. I worked with some of the most extraordinary, thoughtful, brilliant minds that helped me shape my understanding of the political process, of how these things get done, to become a real student of the national parks and the history of the national parks. There were just these amazing people that helped me throughout the whole process that if not for them, this would have never been done.
Right. I don't recall. Did the president come for the final event?
No, he didn't. He wasn't. He went to Yellowstone, which was the first national park. But the Secretary of Interior came to celebrate.
Who was that? Park was.
Secretary Sally Jewell.
Sally Jewell. Yeah. All right. So now the land is transferred. Is it now owned by the federal government?
Yeah, it's owned by the federal government.
And tell me about the endowment. How does the endowment work?
So we established a few million dollar endowment at the National Park Foundation, and the interest from that endowment goes to fund park projects every year. Our initial intent was to have a larger endowment created, but right after this project was done, the Trump administration came in, and you may remember there was a review of national monuments, and there was a thought that they would undo certain national monuments that were created by Democratic presidents, Bill Clinton and Barack Obama. And so we were a bit under the microscope and for quite a period of time, unsure of whether or not Catawba Woods and Waters was going to make it off the chopping block. And so we thought in order to establish Catawba Woods and Waters in the hearts and minds of people, we should build infrastructure. And so we took some of the money that we were going to that was going to go to the endowment. We decided that we would build infrastructure with that, including the Welcome Center that we're just about complete. We built campgrounds and roads and trails and assisted in the National Park Service's planning and infrastructure. So we thought that would be a better way to enhance the visitor experience early on, so there would be a larger constituency that loved this place and would want to see it protected.
Right. So do you think your model is self-sustaining?
In the sense that there's an endowment that would pay for it, or what is that what you mean?
I mean, yes. I mean, it costs money to run. If it's not within the national park system, it's not going to get an annual appropriation, unless it is. I just don't know.
It does. Yeah. So it is owned by the federal government. It's managed by the National Park Service. Right. And the National Park Service does get a line item in the Department of Interior's budget every year. I think it's a little over $1 million now. So it's not a huge budget, but it pays for the superintendent and it pays for the various staff. I think there's probably close to 15 seasonal staff and several permanent year-round staff now. Right. And as more visitors grow, you know, they'll continue to grow the infrastructure.
Let's talk about the Welcome Center, because that's a whole nother story, isn't it? It's sort of a story within the story.
Yeah, it's a really interesting thing that we were able to do. So when we gave the land to the federal government, we reserved the right on certain parts of the monument to build infrastructure. And it was a negotiation with the Department of Justice, but ultimately they let us for 7 years build these predetermined things in these predetermined spaces. And one of the things that was predetermined was the ability to build a welcome center, or what the National Park Service calls a visitor contact station. And it's a kind of a bit of a technical term, but the idea is to build a center that educates and orients visitors to a certain place. So when the monument was first established, an individual from Wabanaki community took me aside and told me that in this land, while it was our family's to give away, it was taken from Wabanaki people, and that I should know that, and made it very clear that this is something that should be in more people's understanding. And if there's a way to help reestablish Wabanaki community and culture in Katahdin Woods and Waters that I could affect, I should focus my time and energy there. And it really moved me. And I thought, you know, that's right. We should do that. And I thought, well, what if we built a welcome center that was really dedicated to Wabanaki community? So I worked with a number of people from all four of the federally recognized tribes here in Maine, tribal nations. We formed a Wabanaki advisory board and made very clear that we were going to protect their culture and stories throughout the process. But ultimately, the exhibitry, the interpretive framework for the exhibits and the center and the land surrounding the center was drafted by a Penobscot storyteller, and this is the only time that we know of in the National Park Service that interpretation was drafted by a Native person, and most of the exhibitry represents Native stories and history and language and culture, and many Wabanaki artists built the exhibits inside the building. I believe that it'll be one of the more important pieces of civic architecture in Maine and certainly in the National Park Service. It's an extraordinary building, one that I've never seen anything like it in my life. And I'm so incredibly proud to be a part of the process of building it.
Well, I heard on the vine that there was a time when there was a change in course on the exhibitry. When I heard about it, I said, well, now, isn't that wonderful? Because the formulaic response, the National Park Service formula of these welcome centers are just, you know, it's so predictable and it's so sort of monolithic and mechanical and without empathy for whatever else that happened in the place. And so when I heard that there had been this group assembled and that they had essentially had been welcomed into the design process, I thought, well, that it really is going to be different in its entirety. And for that too, I'll say thank you, because that might not have happened. You know, and none of it might have happened if it wasn't for your mother and yourself and all the other people that shared your vision. And when you step back and you look at the kind of contributions that people make to the state of Maine, you know, Acadia was a gift by a family.
Mm-hmm.
And so true with Katahdin. I get emotional thinking about it because it just seems to me such a astonishingly generous, visionary experience. It must be very, very gratifying to see it now come to fruition.
Yeah, certainly in the last few months, you know, as the project is really starting to feel finished, you know, Catan Woods and Waters will go on and it'll evolve, I'm sure. But my role in it is feeling closer and closer to being finished. Yeah. And it's given me a moment to pause and think about how long I've been working on this and how it's come to shape not only a community and a part of Maine, but it's also really had a profound impact and has shaped me and who I am. And I feel incredibly indebted to the people of Maine and the people that have influenced this project and influenced me along the way. It's been such an incredible gift to be able to work on a project like this.
So the framework for these conversations is to evoke the spirit of Maine. If you were going to pick out various, say, nouns or verbs that you feel are correspondent between this particular project and what we would define as the spirit of Maine, or at least dream it as a real thing, what would those words be?
That's such a good question. So many things come to mind, and they in some ways sort of contradict each other, because Maine is it's methodical, and change comes slowly to this place. Yet change that happens here can influence far and wide. And in a lot of ways, I think Maine and its rocky coasts and granite mountain ranges and old weathered forests have a way of changing people and sort of bending people to the way Maine is. It is methodical in that sense. It feels very wise. The landscape here feels incredibly wise to me. It's seen a lot. These old mountains, some of the oldest mountains in the world, and this coastline that's beaten and battered and yet still persists. The people are a nice reflection of that geography in a sense.
Well, it's the best argument for essentially the conservation ethos, the preservation ethos, that you don't have to preserve everything, but you preserve the things that epitomize the values that you want to sustain over time. And when you talked about the history of that place and the evolution of employment and sort of social progress, and all of it is nurtured by the landscape. Without that value, a community becomes bankrupt. A community is lost. It has no core. It has no center. And so the whole idea of wilderness, I think, in Maine appeals to everybody who's there, whether they were born here centuries ago and have been here, lived for millennia, or whether they're new climate migrants. It's the same thing in a way. Why are they drawn to this particular place? And I think it's because our willingness and our commitment to preserve wilderness. This is a huge statement, but it's complemented by the land trusts and all the other sort of conservation easements that landowners are putting on their property in order to sort of maintain the quality of life that you call the spirit of Maine. And I feel that happening more and more and more as things begin to come together and the relationships are revealed. You know, it's not just putting puzzle pieces that can fit together and slowly they comprise a completed image, but it's out there. And there's so much more land out there to be preserved.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, this is a fraction of what's out there.
I've been really excited in the idea of land return. So rather than thinking about preservation or conservation, but returning it back to Wabanaki communities is a really exciting part of, I think, the next phase of work that I'd be doing. And the fact that Maine is being, you know, it's happening here in Maine. We may be slow to change, but we do lead in a lot of ways. There's, you know, right now there's one of the largest, well, the largest land return from an NGO to a tribal nation that's ever happened in America is underway here in Maine right now. So it's pretty exciting to know that we've been doing things a certain way and yet we continue to evolve. And that I think is so critical. You know, the Katahdin region was once known for its papermaking, and now it's known for mountain biking and cross-country skiing and its dark skies and its brilliant forests and the carbon sink that is going to play a vital role in our fight against climate change. So there's, you know, it's a really unique thing that we're part of here.
The idea of return is fascinating to me. My very limited experience with Wabanaki people has taught me so much about how that appreciation is built into the psyche. What happens, though? I mean, nothing can happen. And actually, nothing happening can be good. It's essentially we're grappling with a sort of a cyclical turn of the wheel in value, in how we value land and how we value experience and how the two things interrelate and how that contributes to, you know, a harmonious, progressive civilization. It doesn't mean that we tear it all down and build up the subdivisions. It means we make choices that essentially are progressive, even though they may emulate values from centuries ago. Mm-hmm. To be able to be involved in that and know that it actually needs a team again, it's not one person follow me, how difficult and important that's going to be able to have all that wisdom brought together to kind of envision what it's going to look like in the 21st century. Is that's where I'll look for you next? That will be our next conversation when we talk about land return.
Yeah, that would be a great way to come back and have another conversation. I'd love that.
Okay.
Yeah, this summer is in August is our grand opening, but yeah, it's almost done.
Is there a date for that?
Yeah, I think the ribbon cutting is August 17th or 18th. Something.
And what's going to happen with the Elliottville Foundation? What's that part of your life?
So we're continuing to chug along. We're going to go through kind of strategic planning now and think about what our next projects are going to be. We've been really centered for the last 20 years on Katahdin Woods and Waters. So we're starting to think what our next projects are going to be. I'm thinking working perhaps more in the arts and more with Wabanaki artists. And, you know, I'm going to take a deep breath in August. And that's what I'm really focused on.
Yeah. Right. Well done. Again, I just think it's one of the greatest, most generous gifts made in the history of the state of Maine.
Thank you so much. I really appreciate you saying that.
My guest today has been Lucas St. Clair, president of the Elliottsville Foundation, conservationist, outdoorsman, and philanthropist. This has been Conversations from the Pointed Furs. I'm your host, Peter Neal. Thanks for listening.
Katahdin Woods and Waters National Monument spans 87,563 acres of mountain and forest land in northern Penobscot County, inviting discovery of its rivers, streams, woods, flora, fauna, geology, and the night sky. The public is invited to a first look at Dagalgobimuk Contact Station on Saturday, August 17th from 2 to 5 p.m. and on Sunday, August 18th from 10 a.m. to 4 p.m. Registration is encouraged. Visit friendsofkww.org to learn more. The start of full public hours at Dagalgobimuk Contact Station will be announced at a later date in coordination with the National Park Service.